Every community has a place where people meet and stories are told. The East Coast has stoops, the South has porches, and in Alaska, we have Arctic entries.
Here, Alaskans share their personal stories, funny, sad, and sweet. These stories are originally told at our monthly event in Anchorage. At each live performance, seven people tell a seven-minute-long, true story related to the show's theme.
I'm Jason Brandeis.
And I'm Rosie Robards. Welcome to the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage. Our theme for this show is Up, Up, and Away.
We'll hear stories of breaking trail, taking risks, and leaving it all behind.
Rachel Mills is our first storyteller for this hour. She's originally from Seattle and has her master's in botany. Her research has taken her many places, but she's had to conquer some issues.
When I board an airplane, this is how I introduce myself to my seatmate. Hi, I'm Rachel. I'm a fearful flyer. I will pay you $20 to talk me through takeoff and landing, or I will pay you $100 to hit me in the head so hard you knock me out for this entire flight. Usually they laugh, it breaks the ice, and they're less concerned when they see me crying in about 10 minutes. And it goes okay. So I'm extremely afraid to fly, terrified. I mean, I've never actually caused a plane to make an emergency landing, but I have been comforted by hundreds of strangers unfortunate enough to sit next to me. I have been walked up and down the aisles of airplanes to calm me down by a flight attendant because it was making a turn. It was very scary. And one time, on a Catholic school trip on the way to Washington, D.C., they actually ejected me from my seat, wrapped me in a blanket, strapped me down to three empty seats in the back of the plane to get me to stop screaming that the plane was crashing. I know what you guys are thinking. You probably go, wow, this lady in Alaska does not travel very much. But actually, despite my fear and much to the chagrin of anyone who's ever traveled with me, I have been all over the world. And in all my travels, my three favorite flights in order of unconsciousness are as follows. Number three, the time I flew with Sean Connery a few seats behind me. You really can't be that scared when he's completely sexy and talking with that accent. Number two, the time Qantas accidentally gave me food poisoning. Because, I know, you think it sounds bad, but because you can't be that scared when 7 hours are spent vomiting profusely. You just can't be scared. Okay, number one favorite flight ever. The time I accidentally combined, first and only time, combined liquor and sleeping pills. It was great. The hallucinations were wonderful. And when I boarded the plane, I passed out immediately and woke up in Seattle. So the origin of my fear comes from this perfect trifecta of phobias. First of all, I have claustrophobia, fear of enclosed spaces. All right, I've got aviophobia, fear of flying. I also have thanatophobia, the fear of death. Yeah, I know, okay, you're all afraid of dying. I get it. But I'm diagnosed with a fear of flying. Swear to God, it's so bad I had an existential crisis at the age of 4, worrying about what was my purpose in life because in a few generations, my entire existence would be wiped off the planet. 4. Yeah. Okay, and then I was so afraid of dying, they actually removed me from the Catholic school class when we were doing our death and dying section in religion class. They didn't let me do it because I was too much of a mess. That's how afraid I am of dying. So I have tried everything you can think of to get over my fear of flying. I mean, hundreds of hours of therapy and therapists. I mean, I've tried everybody you can think of. I mean, I've done all kinds of meetings with aviation scientists. I've met with Boeing engineers to understand the physics of flying. Why the heck is it not always falling out of the sky? I have rituals and superstitions that get me on the plane all the time. I think, well, babies are on the plane. No one's going to kill a baby. Right? I used to board early. You know how they let people board early? Yeah, that was me. And I was there crying as I would enter in, and I wanted to make sure the pilots were there. They weren't robots. They were awake, and they're not drunk. I'm a botanist by trade, a very grounded profession. Terra firma is lovely. There's no reason to go in the air as a botanist. It's very nice. So I got a few years ago my dream job here in Alaska, and I was like, oh, this is amazing. I'm going to be a botanist on a field team. I cannot wait. So I came up here, and I get to the office, and the first thing they say to me is, Rachel, we need to do some research on helicopter rotor time and rental fees. And no problem. Okay, so this is for the air quality team, right? No, this is for the wetland team. You. Yeah. what? I thought for just a brief moment, oh my God, I didn't tell them about my fear of flying. I'm about to lose my dream job. What the heck am I going to do? And so I did the research, and later they come back a few weeks later and they say, great work on that report. So we're going to need you to do some stats now. Stats, okay, no problem. I love stats. I'm a scientist. I can do stats. Yeah, it's going to be on helicopter crash statistics and on fixed wing crash statistics. Oh, focus on mortality rates. I mean, seriously, you're really not making this easy for me. I couldn't believe it. So I went ahead, did the research. It was very interesting. Okay, I got it done. But in the end, I was like, I can't let this fear conquer me. I mean, I can do this. So I decided to not tell them and continue on with the process. And eventually the day came, it was time to get on the helicopter. And I'm approaching this little tin can. It's very small. But hey, the pilot's there. I can see him. He's awake. This is good. So I get on the flight, and they let me in the front because it's my first time on a helicopter. And all of a sudden, the rotors start going, and the helicopter's kind of bouncing a bit, right? And then it lifts off, but it was smooth. It just lifted off the ground, and it wasn't scary at all. I mean, I could still look at the pilot. He's still there. This is good. And it ended up not being as scary as I thought, and pretty soon I was just fascinated by the fact that I'm flying over remote Alaska in areas that people maybe have never been to or never walked, and I'm seeing all of this from this tiny little machine that is somehow staying afloat, and it really wasn't that scary. In the end, I mean, it became so pedestrian to fly to these different locations that I was reading the newspaper sometimes in the helicopter, and you look out and go, oh, moose, bear. You know, it wasn't a big deal anymore. I wasn't scared. I was so proud of myself. I mean, I hadn't actually conquered my fear of flying. To actually get through the flying, back in the day, I had to do hypnotherapy. That's what finally got me to the point that I wasn't a crying, sobbing mess all the time. But I didn't let it rule me, right? You know, I'm not actually controlled by my fear. And here I am out in the wilderness in Alaska in helicopters, and I'm so cool. So fast forward to like 2 years later, my work says, you know, hey, you know, we like what you're doing. We're going to have you do a research project or an outreach project. And it's going to be in the North Slope. Okay? Remote village, sound good? Yeah, I'm fine with that. I'm good with flying. I can do it. No problem. Tiny plane. Sure. Okay. So we get out to Barrow, and we get in this tiny plane, and they say, does anyone want to sit with the pilot? Yeah, I want to sit with the pilot. I want to sit up there in the front. There's like six seats. Yeah, best leg room. Duh. So I'm up there with the pilot, and I'm thinking, okay, this is a real tiny plane. I don't know about this one. So we take off, and it's in the wintertime, and it was smooth as could be. And I'm thinking, wow, okay, this isn't that scary. I can do this tiny plane. I got this. And I'm looking out. Snow's covering the whole North Slope. It's incredible. And I'm thinking, I have done this. I have gotten my fear under control. I can do this. I am the most badass botanist in this entire town. I am amazing. And I'm looking out in the landscape, and I want to share this moment. So I look to the pilot to look at him and say, yeah, I've done it. He's asleep.
This is the Arctic Entries Radio Hour, where we hear true stories told by Alaskans. That last storyteller was Rachel Mills of Anchorage.
Before our next storyteller's family moved to Anchorage, they developed quite a reputation in Chicago.
Well, at least one member of the family did. Here's Bridget Ellis on stage at the Alaska Center for the Performing Arts.
At age 7, my dad had taught me how to drive our family VW stick shift rabbit, solely because I had insisted that he teach me while teaching my much older sister. And by age 9, he said I was shooting his .357 like Annie Oakley. And at that point, he thought, oh man, I am going to have to keep this girl challenged, focus that energy into something positive so she doesn't get into trouble. And it wasn't long later that he approached me and he had a book in his hand, the Guinness Book of World Records, and he said, Bridge, what would you think about doing a project together? And anything I could do with my dad, I was game. He was my hero and still is, and I was known as his little shadow. So I said, yeah, you know. So we flipped through the pages trying to find something we could do together, and, well, I didn't feel like growing the longest nails in the world, and we didn't feel like making the biggest pizza either, so we kept flipping, and then he landed on the flying records. Now, I knew my dad was a private pilot. But I'd never seen him fly. My dad and mom were raising four little girls, and he was in full-time school, so there was no money for anything extra. And I knew my grandpa had been a World War II bomber pilot. So I perked up, and he pointed to a record, and he said, "Well, look at this one." And it was for the youngest pilot to solo an aircraft. And it, currently, a kid had broken that record at 10 years old. He was from the U.S., but done it down in Mexico. And he turned to me and said, "Well, what do you think about flying?" And I said, "Sounds good to me." My mom did not say those words. She was not thrilled. And actually, she said she was scared to death of this plan. But she, you know, did her own analysis and finally gave her blessing. Now, my dad sat me down and said, "Now, Bridge, we are not doing this for fame or glory. We are doing this to teach you how to set a goal and achieve it." And you know, there's going to be trials and challenges and obstacles that come up, but the trick is to not let it deter you. And we also want to teach you how to work together with people as a team, because this is going to take a lot of good people to pull off. So I said, okay. So we knew we had two major challenges right up front. One was, how are we going to pay for this? And two, who was going to teach me how to fly? I was about 4'3" and 60-something pounds. So first, my dad found some funding from a wonderful man who said, "Well, I like people with get up and go, so I'm in." Next, my dad, one Sunday evening, him and I went down to the local airport in Chicago and walked up to the counter. And the guy behind the counter named Mike said, "How may I help you?" And my dad said, "Well, we're looking for someone kind of crazy." And then he explained a little bit further. And he said, "We're looking for someone to teach this little girl how to fly. Someone that wants to be part of breaking a world record with us." And Mike said, "I think you found your man. But you're going to have to get the okay from the owner." And so the owner said, "Well, I need to make sure this is something she wants to do and that she has what it takes. So Mike, take her up." So Mike took me up on one of the windiest days in Chicago because he thought, "Well, if she can handle this, she can handle about anything." Well, little did Mike know that I loved roller coasters. And so I was having the time of my life, grinning ear to ear. So we came back down, and Mike said, "Yep, she has what it takes, I think." But Mike and I realized we had another huge issue. How was I going to reach the controls? Because from where my hands and feet ended and they began was a long distance. But through some brainstorming and help of some friends, we had devised some wooden foot pedal extensions that easily hooked onto the rudder pedals. And with some help of some good old-fashioned phone books and cushions below and behind me, we were in business. So Mike and I flew and flew for months after that, until one day, he admitted later, "I was so close to just getting out of that airplane and letting you go. You were ready. I had taught you everything I knew." But we had another huge issue. We still had not figured out a way to do it legally. So the boy who had did it in Mexico. Anything goes in Mexico. But we were in the U.S., you know, and we wanted to do a U.S. national record. So, you know, my dad, I remember nights that he wrote letter after letter to congressmen and aviation icons and celebrities trying to get some support to get a FAA waiver so I could do this flight, but to no avail. I did receive one letter back from Gina Yeager, the woman who flew the Voyager around the world nonstop, and she wrote me a letter of encouragement saying, "Don't give up." And she followed it up with some phone calls, and I was later able to meet her in person. But then one day someone ran up to us and said, "Hey guys, have you seen this?" And it was a newspaper article of a kid that had just broken the record that I'd been working for. But it's okay. Luckily, I was still younger than him, but he had cut the time frame we were working with by a considerable amount. But the great thing about him doing this is that he had shown us how to do it. Woo! And so that was pretty exciting. So it turns out that it was legal for anyone to fly a one-seater ultralight. And if you're not familiar with what an ultralight is, it's basically like a lawn chair on wheels and with a prop and engine behind you and nothing in front of you and really no instruments. There was like this little plastic thing. It never worked. And so we set out to find someone that would teach me how to fly. this ultralight. And we found a man named Rodney, and he was wonderful. And he said, I'm game, but I have to make sure it's, you know, conditions are perfect because these airplanes are really affected by wind. And so, you know, there came one day, and it was perfect. My family, all my sisters were there, my mom and dad, and, you know, we started up the engine, and Rodney said, you know, something just doesn't sound right. And my parents said, then we don't go, even if that means we miss the deadline. And another day came, and my mom and I looked outside and said, you know, it seems like the perfect day to go flying. And my sweet mom had been the one running me hours each way to these flying lessons. And, you know, we thought, well, we'd love to call Rodney to see if we could come up. But a fire had just wiped out all the phone lines, so the communication was impossible. And this was before cell phones. So anyways, my mom and I said, well, what the heck, we'll just drive up there. So we drove up there, and we found Rodney. And he said, you know what, today is the perfect day to do this. And I know your dad's not here. But these three gentlemen, locals at the airport, are willing to sign their names to paper as your witnesses if you do this record-breaking flight today. And my mom and I talked about it and said, you know, Dad would understand. He would want us to do this. Go for it. So I got into this one-seater ultralight that I had never flown before because that was the only thing legal to do. And Rodney had put 60 pounds of lead shot in it, hopefully weighing it down enough. So... And so I taxied out, and Rodney's walking alongside of me, and I positioned myself on the beautiful green grass airstrip that laid out before me. And because, like, remember, it's a lawn chair on wheels. So anyways, that was perfect. And so I sat there, though, and there's a picture of that moment. And I'm just this little kid when I look at this picture, and I'm looking up at him with these trusting eyes, and he's bending down towards me. And I remember what he said right then. He said, now, Bridge, remember, you need to start with the stick down and then slowly bring it up, or else this thing's going to shoot up like a rocket. So I was noted. And so then, but he looked at me with eyes so serious and said, are you ready? And I remember looking at my hand on that throttle thinking, all I have to do is just push it forward and I'll be flying by myself. Everything we worked for, right here. Push it forward, Bridge. And so I sat there and I thought and looked at my hand, looked at Rodney, looked at my hand. And I took a deep breath and I said, I'm ready. And as the Chicago headlines would soon after report, on May 11th, 1988, pint-sized pilot Bridget Ellis soared her way into the record books as the youngest pilot to soar an aircraft at 9 years, 9 months, and 3 days. Things got a little crazy after that. So a short while later, a news reporter woman was interviewing me, and she asked me a question, something along the lines of, did you ever think you couldn't do this because you're just so small? And I thought, that is the most ridiculous question I've ever heard. I matter-of-factly answered her back, if you put your mind to something, you can do it. Doesn't matter whether you're big or small. And to my sweet parents, I wanted to tell them, thank you for teaching me just that. I love you.
That was the world-renowned Bridget Ellis. And this is the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage.
During this hour, we hear Alaskans tell short 7-minute stories about their lives. Our theme is Up, Up, and Away, stories of breaking trail, taking risks, and leaving it all behind. For his midlife crisis, our next storyteller, Eric Glatt, bought something more expensive than flight lessons, or even a Porsche.
9 years ago, in September 2008, I woke up to the news that my employer had been taken over by the federal government in order to avert a global financial meltdown. I was working for AIG on Wall Street in a job I didn't really necessarily love, but I was doing because it was a job and I thought it was a steady, reliable way to earn a living, in essence, reflecting my refugee immigrant parents' work ethic. Now, a lot of people had different reactions to the AIG bailout, and among my reactions were a lot of soul searching about what I was doing with my career and with my life and what I really wanted to be doing. So after surviving several rounds of layoffs, I decided I was going to chuck it all and pursue a road not taken that had long been in the back of my mind that I'd always wanted to do, and see if I could start a career as a documentary filmmaker. And I would not let my ego get in my way. I would humble myself and take any job that would help me further that goal. And that's how I wound up as the 40-year-old intern on the motion picture Black Swan featuring Natalie Portman. Now, when I was in my early 20s, I'd never heard of unpaid internships. It was a completely foreign concept. And so the whole experience was a little puzzling. But it became clearer and clearer that what was going on was all of the non-union departments were staffing all of their entry-level positions with young adults who were working for free. Now, this didn't seem right to me, of course, not least because my hardworking colleagues weren't getting paid for their hard work, but also because I realized when I was their age, I couldn't have afforded to do this. It was an opportunity that I would not have had. And the more I thought about that, I realized if this is the way you're supposed to get your foot in the door, institutionalizing this practice is a way of slamming that door in your face before you can even get your foot out. And I realized that for so many people who may have dreams like I had, this was a way for these industries to say, this is not for you. You can go look for your career somewhere else. So I continued my career and had other jobs, paid jobs. But this continued eating away in the back of my mind because I'd keep seeing advertisements and I could see how prevalent this practice was. And after a while, I couldn't let it go and I would start chiming in on job boards when someone would post something and get myself kicked off the job board. Or I would write to a producer who'd posted something that to me looked not only wrong, but at this point I realized probably also in violation of minimum wage laws. And if I got an answer at all, it was basically, there's plenty of people willing to do this if you're not going to do it, so I don't even know why you wrote. So all this did was get me both feeling more frustrated, but also more determined. And I tried organizing people. Most people in their early 20s didn't go to film school to become organizers. They want to pursue a career in the film industry. So that wasn't getting anywhere. The job boards were closed to me. And the longer this went on, the more frustrated I became, and the more incensed I became that it was so accepted just as normal. Ultimately, I decided the only way that was any difference was ever going to be made would be if someone filed a lawsuit. I assume someone must have already done that. Nope, no one had. So I started digging into the law and figured out I probably had a good case, but I had no idea what to do. How do you bring a lawsuit? I asked friends who were lawyers. I wrote to lawyers I found on the internet. Either they would say, this is a kind of crazy idea, no one's ever done this before, minimum wages for an internship doesn't make any sense to us. I even reached out to the Department of Labor and they couldn't really help. At this point, I felt incredibly frustrated and actually kind of lonely. Even my friends who over drinks would say, yeah, I see you've got a point, would say, do not do this. You have defined career suicide. And the more people said no to me, the more determined I was to do something. I just couldn't understand how this could be accepted as normal. And mind you, this is after the recession. So young adults were facing skyrocketing unemployment, and they're being saddled with historic levels of student loan debt. How are they supposed to pay those off with these unpaid internships replacing entry-level work? It was angering. And after giving up on ever finding a way to do something about this, you know, it just felt like the systems in place were just designed to keep little voices from ever being heard. I got an email from a journalist friend who said, hey, I just got out of a meeting with a senior partner at a law firm. They represent plaintiffs, workers, and class action lawsuits. He'd love to hear from you. That day, I had my description of my crazy idea for a lawsuit in that guy's inbox. The next day, I was in his office meeting with lawyers, nodding their heads, and I thought, oh my God, there might be actually something we can do about this. That month, we were in federal court, and there was a media frenzy following the filing of the lawsuit, and that blew me away. Never in a million years did I think anything I did was ever going to receive that kind of attention. And I'll add, that month, September 2011, was also the beginning of Occupy Wall Street, which also told me, in fact, I was not alone. So several months later, well, years later, actually, we finally won the lawsuit. One of the best days of my life was getting the phone call from my lawyer telling me a federal judge thinks your cockamamie idea is not cockamamie at all. I've got the framed check hanging in my apartment to prove it. But more important than our winning our lawsuit is the fact that it led to other lawsuits, dozens of other lawsuits. In total, those lawsuits have been settled in the tens of millions of dollars from employers who had to finally pay for the labor that helped them be profitable. Not only that, but we've transformed entry-level employment in dozens of industries, from the film industry, from the studios, to the TV networks, fashion labels, music labels, publishing. All these industries have now started paying for their interns, fellows, and entry-level workers, the way they always should have been doing. Of course, I was then stuck with a little bit of a problem, which was I turned my back on one industry, very publicly burned a bridge in another, and still had, you know, time left. So I doubled down on the starting over again story and decided to become a public interest lawyer and went to law school. And now I'm a staff attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union of Alaska.
That was Eric Glatt, and this is the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage.
We're about to hear from Leisha Nolan. Leisha is a pediatrician, but she recently decided to hang up her stethoscope to work for public health organizations in the fight against the spread of infectious diseases.
I bet everyone in here knows someone who has the most mild symptom and is sure they have cancer. And probably everybody in here also knows somebody who will walk around for 2 days on a broken leg before they actually go to the hospital. Well, I'm probably a little bit more in that second category, and that's why it makes sense that I have a job responding to outbreaks. So for the past 4 years, I've gone for all different disease outbreaks pretty much all around the world. But the outbreak I'm going to talk about tonight is the Ebola outbreak. So for those of you who either lived in a closet or somehow forgot it, in 2014 was the largest Ebola outbreak we've ever had. Three countries in West Africa were affected by this dramatic outbreak of Ebola. Probably somewhere around 30,000 people got infected, and between a third and a half of them died. And I was there. I went three times to help with the Ebola response in West Africa. And I was there when it was terrible. I was there in the beginning, before things were under control, before we had a system, when people honestly were dying in the street. But tonight's story isn't about what happened while I was in West Africa. It's what happened when I came back to the U.S. So luckily, at the time that I came back from the Ebola response, I was living in a state that was fairly liberal. They didn't lock me in a tent on the airport landing strip. I was actually allowed to go around my daily business. I just had to call in twice a day and tell them if I had any symptoms of Ebola. And so, review for everybody, the symptoms of Ebola are fever, vomiting, and diarrhea. I'm sorry to say, the bleeding from the eyes that you see in all the movies, that's exceptionally rare. So I was doing well twice a day. I was calling into the state and telling them, really, I had no symptoms. Except for one night, I started to not feel great. And it was you know, after dinner kind of time. And I'm like, it's probably nothing. I'm just going to go to bed. I don't have Ebola. It's fine. So I go to bed and I go to sleep. And a few hours later, I wake up and I'm like, ooh, yeah, not feeling so good. So I go in the bathroom, take my temperature, and I'm up to 104. And I'm like, ooh, that's high. Well, I don't have Ebola, so I'll just call the state in the morning. There's no need to worry them in the middle of the night. So I go back to bed and go back to sleep for maybe another 2 hours. And I get up and, whew, not good. And I go in the bathroom and pretty much empty my entire body out of my bottom into the toilet. And I'm like, yeah, I probably should tell the state about this, but it's like 11 at night. I don't have Ebola. I'll just tell them in the morning. So I go back to bed and I sleep a little longer. I think the next time I wake up is 1 a.m. And this time I go in the bathroom and it's coming out of both ends at this point. And I'm sitting on the toilet with the garbage can in my lap. And I don't know how many of you have vomited so hard you start to black out, where you actually have your vision go out to black because you are heaving so hard. Well, I was at that point. And I realized it might be kind of tacky to drown in my own vomit in this trash can with my pants down in the bathroom. So I'm like, maybe I should call the state. I mean, I don't have Ebola, but I'll call the state. So I call the state, and it turns out they really had no idea what to do. So between the hours... between 1 a.m. and about 3 a.m., I think I talked to about 15 different doctors, scientists, everybody. And it came down to that, yeah, you know, I don't have Ebola, but maybe I should get checked out and just, you know, cover the bases. So we all agree that I should get to the hospital. And they say, well, can you drive yourself there? And I say, I don't have a car. And honestly, right now, I don't think I can bike to the emergency room. And we both agree that it would not be good PR for me to take a taxi right now. So they agree they're going to send an ambulance. So I'm thinking, okay, good. It's about 5 o'clock now. The ambulance will come. And it's early. Nobody's going to see me get in the ambulance with people in the Ebola suits, right? The Ebola contagion outbreak suits. That's my vision, that there's going to be photographs of them coming to my house. But at 5 a.m., no problem. The ambulance arrives at 11, a little later. It was obviously an emergency. And I go out onto my porch, and the ambulance driver clearly had essentially the same idea as I did, because he pulled up, he rolled down his window, and he says, can you walk to the ambulance? And I say, yeah. So I walk around to the back of the ambulance, open the doors, and there's the people in the Ebola suits, but I'm the only one who can see them, so no photos for the news. I get in, they put me in an Ebola suit, which I still don't really understand, and I get driven to the ER, and in the ambulance, right, it's all cool, the nurse is calm, I tell her, don't worry, I don't have Ebola, and it's all cool. We get to the emergency room, and remember, I'm in the yellow Ebola suit, right, and they put me in a wheelchair, and an orderly comes out, and he's pushing me through the emergency room, and he is going, stop! Clear! Everybody out of the way! Somebody's like walking down a hallway towards us, and he's like, back up! Back up! And it's the opposite of the experience in the ambulance. There's utter chaos. I get to my room, and there is a nurse in there with the full Ebola garb on. She has a mask over her face and her nose. She has a screen in front of her face, and she is nervous as hell. And it turns out this poor woman is essentially locked in the room with me for as long as I'm going to stay there, because they don't want anybody going in and out. So she's in the room with me. The rest of the doctors and nurses just come to the door and stand there and shout to me saying, how long have you had these symptoms? And getting all my diagnosis from the door. Well, it turns out about 5 hours later, I did not have Ebola. And during this whole time, the nurse is just getting more and more nervous, and she's actually fogging up the part in front of her face. And any time she gets nervous, she would take her gloved hand and go up and wipe the inside of her face mask so she could see. And so when it finally becomes clear that I don't have Ebola, the rest of the doctors and nurses then start coming into the room to discuss things with me. And the thing I thought was very kind is the church nurse came into the room and she says, well, I want to thank you very much for giving us the opportunity to practice an outbreak response like this. Do you have any advice for us? And I say, well, you know, I've been doing this for a few months in West Africa, and your nurse, when she went like this and wiped the sweat off inside of her mask, well, that's when she would have gotten Ebola. And they're like, oh, well, thank you very much. So I was happy. I didn't have Ebola. I got to go home. And of course, like any adult these days, I went home and instantly put it on social media that I'd had this amazing experience. And it turns out 6 of my friends had exactly the same symptoms I did. None of them had been to West Africa or anywhere near anybody with Ebola. But interestingly, all of us the night before had gone to a potluck.
That was Leisha Nolan on stage at the Alaska Center for the Performing Arts. This is the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage. Okay, we have two more stories to share with you this hour. Next up, we'll hear from Naya Kaur Queth, a business owner in Anchorage and mother of nine.
As you can see, I'm not from Alaska. Or from the United States. So I'm just going to say I'm from South Sudan, but was born in refugee camp in Ethiopia. A little bit, so you can understand where I'm coming from with this story. When I was 7 and a half, my mom cousin took me to a camp. They would call it the military base here, but over there it was a rebel camp where my father's colleague was staying. When war broke out in Sudan for the very first time before I was born, my father was one of the rebel fighters, the very first group that started, which called Anyanya One. And 1972, I believe there was a peace, which I didn't know. And 1975, they started to break out again and form another rebel fighter, which called Anyanya Two. My father was part of it. So that camp, all my father's colleague was staying there, including one of the general who was leading the group. So my father left the group and came to a place called Itang, where I was born, and concluded that he's going to stay there because there was some disagreement going on between the group. The man called John Garang, who led the whole SPLA until 2005, came in 1983 to join the first group, but these two groups had a disagreement who was supposed to be the leader of the movement. So my father didn't want to be part of these two groups fighting each other because they all left Sudan for the same cause. So we live in Itang, and John Garang came to Ethiopian government and asked for assistance and asked that all the refugee that was coming out of Sudan to be given a place to live or a refugee camp in Ethiopia. So Ethiopian government agreed and refugees was coming out in 1983 and they were residing in Itang. And United Nations agencies, they started coming out and giving out help. So I was sent by my mom to her cousin who asked that she want me to, she only have one child who is a grown man and wanted me to stay with her for one season, which was a rainy season. So I went there, I think I stayed there for like a month, and then John Garang decided to crushed the group that was staying in a place called Bilpam, where I was, because since they disagreed, so he decided to take forces there and chase them out so he can control the place. And he asked my father to take a soldier to that camp so they can destroy it. And he was like, wait a minute, my daughter is in that camp. So I can't take that responsibility. And while they left him with no choice, they picked out a different people with the help from Ethiopian government, and they decided to go to that camp. It was early in the morning when a helicopter started flying there, dropping down a lot of soldiers and guns. So my mom started walking from Itang to that military camp, and because these people were flying and she's walking, so it took her all day to get there. By the time she got there, it was too late. The camp was destroyed. So my father couldn't go because of course, they will kill him because he refused. So they thought that since he refused to take that responsibility, that means he's still on the other side of the group. So only female could go because maybe as a mother, she said, I have to take that chance in order to find my daughter. So when those people arrive, where I was staying, there's a river, because they're like two villages. The military camp and the river, there's a river in between. So you have to only take a canoe in order to go over there. So as soon as they started arriving, I saw, woke up in the morning, sunrise, and the war started. So I hear there's a lot of shooting, there was a lot of fire, and I didn't know where to go. I was only about 7 and a half, and the lady who was supposed to be my supervisor was taking care of me. She left for a wedding that night, and in the morning, the war started, so I didn't know what to do. I had a neighbor who barely knew, and everybody started packing up. They was leaving, and the houses started burning because of the fire back and forth, back and forth. So I started running between the houses, hiding, coming back out and hiding, didn't know what to do. So I saw this lady, she was packing up and leaving, and her husband yelled at her, calling her by name, Nyantut, don't leave. Nyakaka daughter, he referred me by my mom's name, and she decided to stay with me until the war cooled down. So the people from the other side realized that they are in control now, so they can come to this side of the river. So they took a canoe and came to the other side and found us by the tree hiding. And he stood in front of me with a gun because he came to us. And he's like, I didn't know what language he was speaking because he was a Dinka soldier. So he had a gun pointed in my face. And I'm looking at the gun and like, what is he going to do with that? I didn't understand. And the lady knew that he's trying to kill us, so she's blocked me and asked the guy to kill her in the state. So the other guy who was in charge from the other side, they was looking at us and they called him out to stop. They sent other more people and asked him to stop. And that lady saved my life because she didn't leave, and also she nearly gave up her life to save me. As soon as those guys came, they took me, put me into the canoe, and they took me to the other side of the river. And another lady came at night. She picked me up, took me to her house, and where I met my mom that night. And the lady who saved my life, I didn't see her after that until today. I don't know where that lady is. In 2010, I went to Khartoum for the very first time. And I met the general who was in charge of that camp, who's my father's colleague, and I went to his house. And I asked him for this family, the guy and a wife. And I was confirmed, they told me that he was killed, but his wife, she's still alive and remarried. But they was not sure where. A lot of people from South Sudan migrated to United States, Canada, and Australia. Until today, I ask. I've been to Canada. I always ask of her if anybody know her. Here in the United States, I always ask of her. I know what tribe exactly where she from, but I still don't know if she's here or not. Now that the war broke out again, so I pray that she'd make it out, and hopefully one day I will be able to meet her so I can say thank you. That's my story.
You're listening to the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage. That was Nyakor Queth at the Alaska Center for the Performing Arts.
We have just one more story this hour. Here's Larry Howell providing a window into the early days of the Alaska Pipeline.
Well, it's 1974. I've just graduated from Diamond High School. I'm headed off to college. My intent is to be the first of my family to ever earn a degree. I was headed toward medical school, I thought. And then I ran into a problem. That problem was called organic chemistry. I don't know a doctor that's ever gotten his MD without having organic chemistry. So with that problem, and another problem was that I was in a private school, Willamette University in Oregon, and the tuition for that sophomore year looked like it was unattainable. I had only enough for that first freshman year. And then all of a sudden, I discovered Time magazine. And in Time magazine, there's a story about the oil companies are going to build this 800-mile-long pipeline across my home state, Alaska. And I'm thinking, aha, here's my opportunity. I have a professor friend of mine that befriended me. We have a racquetball partner. And I called him immediately. I went over to his office with a magazine. I showed him the article about how this Trans-Alaska pipeline was going to be built. I said, Buzz, I've got a plan. His name is Richard Allen Buzz Yoakum. I said, Buzz, I've got a plan. Here's the deal. I think it'll take me 5 days to get home. I think I'll get home. I can get to Fairbanks. I can hire out of Fairbanks. And when I get to Fairbanks, I'll get a job with one of the unions, and I'll make this much money. But I've got to drop out of school. And he looked at me and he said, no, Larry, you will not drop out of school. What I will do is I will give you a leave of absence for 1 year. But you have to promise me that you'll be back in my office the following September. Well, about a month later, I'm in Fairbanks. I have hired on the pipeline. I'm working with the 798 Union. That was the welders union. I fly up to Franklin Bluffs camp. 1,100 men, 97 women. Odds are good for some, not so good for others. My first job was a welder's helper. I was just buffing these wells off. But then what happened is an opportunity in the pipe gang ahead of me came up, and I got to be what was called a bead grinder. Bead grinder I liked. It was more physical, a lot more action, an extra couple bucks an hour, longer hours. Everything was perfect. So I'm working as a bead grinder in the pipe gang. Now, the 798 is an interesting group of people. They're from the Deep South. It's a union based in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Pipelining with them is a family business. And that family business all came out of Tulsa. The only thing that 798ers didn't like, 798ers didn't like Alaskans in their union. And the only thing worse than an Alaskan kid in their union was probably an Alaskan Teamster. And some of you have been around long enough to know that there was quite a rivalry between the Teamsters and the 798ers. Anyway, I'm a teenager up there, but I'm an Alaskan kid, so that's working against me. But I'm actually a smart mouth college kid taking a working man's job. You know, history will tell us, if you look at the Klondike, if you look at the California Gold Rush, that most of the money was probably not made by the workers, but that was made by those people selling different goods and other services to those miners. And the Alaska Pipeline was not much different than that. On the Alaska, there was an opportunity one time. I spent about 5 weeks, or maybe 2 or 3 months, in a camp called Garbeth Lake. I met a buddy that was made friends with him, and he had his own truck and trailer rig. We worked a deal with Cut Rate Kid Liquor Store here on Fireweed Lane in Anchorage, and we were buying whiskey by case lots at a huge discount. I'm here to tell you that all the camps north of the Yukon River were actually dry camps, but I guarantee you the drink of choice in Galveth Lake was Crown Royal, and I clearly controlled the price of that Crown Royal in that camp. All these pipeliners and all these workers, they're hanging around, they don't have any place to spend their money, they've all got pocket knives. I'm looking at this buck knife, and I'm thinking that's kind of an ugly knife. My dad gave me a Gerber knife when I was a kid, and I had a Gerber knife. So I worked a deal with Gerber Legendary Blades in Tigard, Oregon, and we worked through a sporting goods store in Fairbanks. I'd make a phone call from the camp. They'd send a case of knives up. Gerber's Folding Sportin' 2, $29.95. I sold them for $50 each. But I'd give you a discount if you bought 10 or more to $40. So, now there was we'd had some inclement weather. You can't weld in the super cold when the wind is blowing and snowing, 20 below chill factor. And so there's bus time. Well, what happens with bus time? You might be on the bus for about an hour. You might be on a bus for 2 days when that snow's blowing. You can't weld in that kind of weather. So what we did is but the poker games would bring out. So the way it worked is you'd turn your check in on a Friday, you'd endorse it, the paymaster on Sunday would give you cash. So here was a little window of opportunity for a banker. So you'd take about $1,200 in small bills out to that pipeline on those Fridays and Saturdays and sometimes Sundays. And it was pretty easy to be that banker. A little pile means it's time to make a loan. Big pile in front of that poker player, time to go collect on that loan. So as an Alaskan kid, I kind of got in with a group of guys, and actually some of them were my teachers in high school. We ran trap lines, and we had kind of a collection of furs. We had a bunch of lynx and had some wolverine and some pelts, a couple of beavers, things like that. Well, these guys from the south, they would go nuts over Alaskan stuff. So I packed a duffel bag full of those pelts up there, and at Adigan Pass one night, we had a fur auction. I sold a wolverine pelt for $800. You can probably buy three of them today for $800. So all that time on that pipeline, my only connection to the outside world was that professor, that Buzz Yoakum. Every 2 to 3 weeks, Buzz would write me a letter. And in that letter, he'd keep me up on what was going on campus. He'd tell me what my buddies were up to. He told me that my Willamette University rugby team just crushed Oregon State. He told me that, yeah, your girlfriend's seeing another guy, but I don't think she's that interested. So, but the last paragraph in that letter, every time, was virtually the same. And that was, remember, Larry, you will be back in my office the next year. Every 2 to 3 weeks, I'd get these letters from him. My letters to him was what it was like working 12-hour days. I worked a 20-week stint one time. And, you know, so my letters to him had what it was like to work on the pipeline, what it was like, what the people were like on that pipeline. The fact that I paid $100 from a guy with a pickup truck, I paid $100 for a watermelon out of a pickup truck that was driving to North Slope. The type of people I was working with. I talked to him about how I was bootlegging whiskey, how much unconscionable profit I was making. And I also talked about my banking experience. So what was happening was that Buzz and Larry were living vicariously with each other's lives through these letters, this correspondence that went on to each other. He wanted to be on the pipeline, and I desperately wanted to be back on campus. So if I'd only kept those letters, think of the story it would make. So I get back to campus, and I'm looking around, and it's like, these kids haven't grown up. What's going on? And I've got a brand new pickup truck. I've got my own apartment off campus. I've got money for the first time in my life, probably. But most importantly, I've got 3 years worth of tuition and living expenses sitting in the bank earning interest. So, and I'm looking around at my colleagues or my other students, and I'm realizing these are a bunch of smart mouth college kids. they don't know how tough it's going to be out there yet. So I grew up on this pipeline. So that was actually part of my college education, was growing up and, you know, becoming an adult through that whole process and living with those 798ers. I went back. I finally got my degree. I changed from chemistry to economics. I actually wrote my senior econ paper was the supply and demand of selling whiskey in a pipeline camp. You know, there was a certain price elasticity. The price would go up real fast. It didn't come down real fast. So Anyway, at one point after college, I graduated. I went down to California. I picked up a good corporate job down there. That's where I met my wife. I brought her back. We raised our three sons up here. We've had a good life. We lived off this last 40 years of good economy in Alaska that the oil industry brought this state. And quite frankly, there's just no regrets. Thank you very much.
Thanks to Larry Howell and all of the storytellers on this hour of the Arctic Entries radio show.
To hear these stories again or to share them with friends, visit arcticentries.com or alaskapublic.org.
The Arctic Entries website also has information about upcoming themes, live shows, and details on how you too could tell a story.
We'd like to thank our storyboard and the storytellers for this show, all of whom are volunteers, by the way. The proceeds from our live shows are donated to a local social services nonprofit. Information about this is also on our site.
Thanks to Anchorage's own Super Saturated Sugar Strings for our theme music. This show was edited at the Alaska Teen Media Institute by Kendall Stormo. This has been the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage. I'm Jason Brandeis.
And I'm Rosie Robards. Thanks for listening, and we look forward to hearing your stories.
I want to be yours, but I want to be free. What will we do when times get tough? Improve our life or play from the rough? I love the start of new things to come. And I love your lips, wanna give me some. We fuss and fight when things go wrong. Will we laugh and sing every day a new song?
We'll just have to see what will be, will be. We can swim or sink in our new beginning. Oh, I'll just let it be. No more inquiry. Calling out me, no more reassuring. Things are looking up, you're the best of them all. Will I keep my word? Would I have resolved? Eat a little less pork and be nice to you all. Don't need to know what the future stores. Just need your touch, who can ask for more? This year, will my face look the same? Will we fall in love, or just fall like the rain?
We'll just have to see what will be, will be. We can swim on the sea.